And thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight, Black Voices. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. What you should know about the Trump administration's crackdown on diversity, equity, and inclusion programs.
The feeling that I get when I'm living in my own hair, it does have a different breath, and I do have a different walk.
And we sit down with actress Kiki Palmer to talk about her natural hair journey, her new hit movie, and her fave spots in Chicago. And now to some of today's top stories. Mayor Brandon Johnson is accepting an invitation to testify before Congress about Chicago's status as a sanctuary city. The invitation comes from James Comer, Republican congressman and chair of the House Oversight Committee, also requested all documents and communications related to Chicago's sanctuary status, including those between each city, as well as non-governmental organizations and state officials. Johnson has repeatedly said Chicago will remain a welcoming city. He'll appear March 5th alongside the Democratic mayors of Boston, Denver, and New York City. Aggressive braking and slippery conditions were the cause of a 2023 collision on the CTA Yellow Line that injured dozens. That's according to a new report by the National Transportation Safety Board. While the train operator was found to have alcohol in his system at the time of the incident, the board determined it was, quote, unlikely to have contributed. Instead, the NTSB pointed to aggressive braking that resulted in wheel slide, the CTA's decision to disable an automatic track brake feature, and the presence of leaves and an organic gel-like substance on the rails, making conditions more slippery. According to the report, 16 people were hospitalized, treated, and released, while three were critically injured. The CTA estimates the collision resulted in about $8.7 million in damages. Relatives of children in foster care will soon be able to get more financial support and navigate a more flexible custody process. Governor J.B. Pritzker signed the KIND Act into law earlier today in Springfield. The legislation allows family members to get the same monetary support as licensed foster caregivers. The State Department of Children and Family Services will also work to create less burdensome regulations for relatives who step in and become certified. Advocates say a kin-first approach when placing children leads to better social, behavioral, mental health, and educational outcomes.
To take care of additional children, and we need this financial support to do so. But the KIND Act, as it changes and prioritizes kin-first approach for our state, it would make a significant difference for kinship caregivers like myself.
A search is underway for a new leader at Adler Planetarium. Michelle Larson is stepping down as president and CEO after more than a decade on the job to become the president of Clarkson University in upstate New York. The board's chair, Keisha Steelman, says, quote, through Larson's leadership, we have assembled an exceptional senior management team, strengthened the organization's financial and operational capabilities, and established a durable foundation for future success. Chief Financial Officer Ardris Wong will serve as interim CEO. Up next, inside efforts to undermine and eliminate diversity programs. That's right after this.
Chicago Tonight, Black Voices, is made possible in part by the support of these donors.
President Trump's move to do away with diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts in the federal government has also made waves in the public and private sector. Companies like Walmart, Target, and McDonald's recently moved to abandon their DEI initiatives. Backers of Trump's decision say these practices were discriminatory and promoted inequity. But advocates argue social equity initiatives are essential to create a fair and balanced society. Here with more on DEI initiatives are Xavier Ramey, CEO of Justice Informed, a social impact consulting firm, and on Zoom, Jacob Hubert, president of the Liberty Justice Center. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us. Welcome back.
Thank you, Brandis.
Xavier, I want to start with you. What is the historical significance? What's the context behind DEI?
DEI was created as a program in, shortly after the Civil Rights Movement and the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Of course, we created a legislative environment where we said that America was equal and that all persons should be treated equally without discrimination with regards to certain protected identities. However, that doesn't mean that the social application of that was just going to happen. So diversity, equity, inclusion programs were created to start to both incentivize but also hold accountable institutions, communities, and individuals that didn't comply with that law. And so that was sort of the dawn of DEI. Where it's gone since then is a bit further. I'm sure we'll get into that.
Absolutely. What are some of the misconceptions of DEI today?
One, I think it's one of the greatest misconceptions is that it's trying to get unqualified people in when the reality is we're trying to get unqualified people out. DEI is not about trying to get unqualified people of color into high-ranking roles and get women into jobs that they don't haven't worked for and these sorts of things. It's actually to say that America has never had a competitive employment marketplace. When you suppress labor and you don't allow for women to enter into the workplace and you don't have data that shows whether there's a racialized effect in hiring practices for law firms, for instance, eventually you have to ask yourself, why aren't there more black lawyers? Why aren't there more women doctors? Why aren't there more Indian folks working in some of these companies? Like, what's going on here? There's a reason for that. And DEI is an apparatus to level that playing field.
Jacob Hubert, you know, given the history of race and sex and gender discrimination in this country, why wouldn't DEI help move equity forward?
Look, we have the Constitution that requires the government to treat everybody equally, regardless of their race. We have laws that prohibit race discrimination, and we have plenty of lawyers who are willing to go to bat for people who've been discriminated against based on their race, and that's all very good. But what we're talking about with these programs that President Trump has sought to eliminate are programs that promote people or give people positions based on their race or their sex or a characteristic like that, rather than on their qualifications for the job. And so what I think President Trump is saying, or what a lot of people believe right now, is that we should get all kinds of racial discrimination out of our government, whether any kind of racial preference, and just treat people as individuals, hire people who are qualified, and if there is invidious discrimination going on in any direction, get rid of that discrimination.
Do you think that just simply being more mindful of the barriers that history has erected for some folks in this country, do you think that that is a form of discrimination?
I don't think we're really talking about anybody being mindful here. What we're talking about and what the president got rid of are programs that actually make decisions about who will be hired, who will be promoted, and that sort of thing based on race, sex, and characteristics like that. You know, people want to say, oh, you don't want to teach children about slavery? You don't want to teach military cadets about the Tuskegee Airmen? That's not what this is about. That's a total straw man that people bring up to cover the fact that what we're really talking about is getting rid of discrimination, treating everybody as equal individuals and judging them and giving them positions and pay based on their merit. That's all this is actually about. And I think people are tired of the kind of racial division that proponents of these programs so often stoke to try to tell some people they're victims and other people they're oppressors and set them against one another. You know, racial conflict, unfortunately, people feel it, has increased in recent years because there are so many determined to stoke this conflict and profit from it on every side. And what I think this push against DEI is really about is saying, no, forget race, forget all of that, and let's go back to treating each other as equal individuals.
I want to hear a clip briefly from White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt. She's discussing the removal of funding to DEI programs.
It is the responsibility of this president and this administration to be good stewards of taxpayer dollars. That is something that President Trump campaigned on. That's why he has launched DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, who is working alongside OMB. And that's why OMB sent out this memo last night, because the president signed an executive order directing OMB to do just this. And the reason for this is to ensure that every penny that is going out the door is not conflicting with the executive orders and actions that this president has taken. So what does this pause mean? It means no more funding for illegal DEI programs.
Illegal DEI programs. Jacob, are DEI programs illegal?
Yes, if they are giving people benefits, privileges, jobs, promotions based on race or sex. That the law makes that illegal across the board, and it doesn't say you can discriminate against this race, you can discriminate against, in favor of that race. The law demands that the government especially treat everybody equally. And so if you have programs that aren't doing that, yes, they are illegal. If it's the government doing it, they violate the Constitution.
Okay, so while we're on it, let's talk a little bit about private companies, because the executive order from the White House focused on funding DEI programs at a federal level, but we're also seeing private companies, Walmart, Target, McDonald's, they're also abandoning their DEI initiatives. Xavier, I want to come to you first. Why do you think that is?
Well, partly because I think they believe things that, like what Mr. Huber just said, they think the DEI is about creating these checkboxes and giving unqualified people jobs. They think the DEI is about training people to hate. And the reality is that most people don't even know how to love. What we're teaching them is how to include persons that they most likely don't live around. The reality is most white Americans do not live around an African American. And most African Americans don't live around persons who are of Indian descent. We are a segregated country. And in order to actually create a space that is equal, when we come into an integrated space, such as the workplace, and the workplace is the most integrated space for the majority of Americans, not their homes, then we have to do the work of understanding how to teach them to do the work of integration, to live up to those values that the Constitution says, which is that we are not only all created equal, but we are to be treated equally. We're not training people or teaching people to hate. We're not using race as a straw man. What we're doing is letting people know that you don't know what race is and how it's affected people. I would challenge Jacob to consider, why is it that there are less than 5% of the partners in major law firms across the United States who are African American? And why are the majority of them white men? Why is it that 91% of all venture capital dollars go to white male businesses, yet we have white men in Texas going to the Supreme Court saying that small business grants to women of color is somehow unconstitutional because they can't apply for that when 91% of the money goes to white men, but they'll shut down all the apparatuses for getting data about the why, things like the EEOC, things like the Consumer Financial Protections Bureau. They'll shut those down like President Trump is doing right now to ensure we can't measure just how unequal it is, and then say that counting inequality is a form of injustice and creating programs to address it is a form of discrimination. So, it's disingenuous.
So the president, he brought up DEI in the face of tragedy just last week. Let's take a listen.
FAA's diversity push includes focus on hiring people with severe intellectual and psychiatric disabilities. That is amazing. And then it says FAA says people with severe disabilities are most underrepresented segment of the workforce, and they want them in, and they want them. They can be air traffic controllers. I don't think so.
Jacob, is there a danger in baselessly faulting DEI for a failure like this?
Yeah, I don't know, you know, where the president gets his notions about this. I don't know too much about that specific situation. But, you know, the question was raised, well, why are, you know, only 5% of law firm partners, if that's the case, people of color or whatever the statistic is? Well, I would say if you wonder why certain demographic groups are underperforming, let's look at the schools that we force them to attend. Look at the Chicago public schools that have been failing minority children for decades. And look at the people in this country who don't want those families to have a choice. Wouldn't you know it, it's the same public sector unions and other interest groups that push DEI. I think these people, if they're really concerned about this sort of thing, should take a look at why people lack opportunities. It's because they lack educational choice. It's because they have a government that puts up barriers to entrepreneurship that make it difficult for people to succeed. It's about people who profit off of keeping people dependent and in bad schools. If you're not talking about that, then I question very much whether someone is really about the success of everyone or if someone is about profiting from racial division.
Okay. I wish we could talk about this a whole lot more, because I know that both of you have a lot of thoughts and a lot more to add. I'm sure it is a conversation that we'll have to keep having. Until then, that is where we're going to have to leave it. Xavier Ramey and Jacob Huber, thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brandis.
Up next, one-on-one with the one and only Keke Palmer. Stay with us. Actress, singer, author, podcaster, and everybody's best friend, Keke Palmer, is having a moment. She's been a mainstay on our screen since she was a kid in movies like Aquila and the Bee. But we've also seen her in more mature projects like Jordan Peele's film Nope and hosting the red carpet at the Met Gala. The Chicago area native is in town this week to celebrate natural hair and Black History Month at the DuSable Black History Museum. She's also fresh off the release of her latest film, One of Them Days.
I'm sorry.
I didn't forget it. I swear to God.
I wasn't trying to be... Because actually, you're on time. I got off at 7.
Damn.
I got you good, yeah.
You know me so well.
And I still got you this.
That's my girl. Extra cheese?
Yes, and I really shouldn't have done it because you're going to blow up the bathroom link.
Don't worry about me. I'm going to be fine. Two kisses up to God and I'm going to be straight.
What does that have to do with your stomach? This is not dirty.
God heals all things.
Girl, you're lactose.
Tummy's included. Tummy's included.
We were working on One of Them Days for about 6 years, Issa and I, Sarita Singleton, and the whole Hooray team and Sony, obviously. So to get to that point and feel proud at the end, which we all did for the work that we did, but then to know that other people enjoyed it, I think that's the best feeling ever. That's what you would hope to happen, and that's what happened for us.
This movie gets talked about a lot as, you know, sort of a Black female lead buddy comedy. Mm-hmm. How do you see this film? What do you think it, what's the story? What's the takeaway?
Well, I mean, I definitely would not take away the fact that it is a Black female-led buddy comedy. I have pride in that. I also think it's a movie about friendship, about community. You know, the movie hits on a lot of important themes of gentrification and also just the cycle of poverty. You know, credit hold you back. But at the core of it, it's about the fact that in life, wherever you are, these things are going to happen, and it's who you have by your side that helps to get you through. And I think that that's, like, really important to remember, especially in times like this. And for me as an artist, telling that story with a comedy spin is always, to me, the best medicine.
It's been likened to, like, the Female Friday, or compared to BAPS from years ago, or Girls Trip, right? Why do you think there are not more comedies like this one?
I mean, there's so many reasons as to why that could be. I think the main one is a lot of times the people that would write them aren't even close enough to the stove for it to catch fire. You know what I mean? So it's like getting the right people in the rooms at the right time. And I think that's the excitement around people like Issa Rae or Quinta Brunson or Jordan Peele, is once people do break through like they have, they can then usher in some of these projects. Like, you know, I don't know that people would know who Sarita Singleton was unless it was an Issa Rae that could identify and say, hey, this, guys, there's a world for this. And the crazy thing about it is that people want to see worlds outside their own. You know, we want to go to the movie theater and see something different, wherever, you know, this person's a spaceship, you know, maker, or, you know, this is an astronaut, or this is a swimmer. And so if we did lean more, if we could get more people to be able to get these stories into the right hands, I think they would have the same success.
The film also shows some love to the city of L.A. at a time when the city can use it. Do you ever see yourself doing any sort of similar Chicago productions that sort of give Chicago the same love?
Well, you know, I grew up loving John Hughes, you know, and loving those films, which obviously take place in Chicago or Illinois. And so I would love to do that. It would be an honor. It's so funny. I don't think I've ever actually played a character that's in Chicago, which is, I feel like I have a very Chicago-sounding voice, too. So, you know, so I think it's crazy that I haven't yet, but I would love to.
What are the places or what are the spots you love to hit up when you're in town?
Okay, whenever I'm here, my favorite spot to hit up is always going to be my parents' house. You know, and then if it's not my parents' house, then I'm definitely going to cousins, family, all the family stops. I love Alinea. It's like one of my favorite restaurants here just because the food is so unique, you know. And then you're always going to be good with Portillo's or Harold's or any of that.
Classics.
Garrett's. You know, those are classic things I feel like I don't even need to say. You know, and then just walking around the shops. Like I always say, growing up in the South Suburbs, I didn't get to go to the city a lot. And so when I finally did start going to the city as a teenager, I was like, oh, wait a minute, Chicago is really fire. Like, I didn't realize that this city, like, New York who?
Never heard of her.
Right, never heard of her.
So you grew up, obviously, in the spotlight as a childhood actor, and your look has evolved through the years, and now you're a brand ambassador for Cream of Nature, obviously.
Yes.
What would you say your hair journey has been like?
Man, my hair journey has been intense. Obviously, growing up in Illinois, going to private school, it was like straight hair is what it needed to be. And I think it created a weird relationship with my hair over time. So when I was about 23 or 24, maybe 23, I cut it all off, shaved it all off and started from the top and really started to have more of a personal relationship with my hair and remembering what it was like to do things with it, you know, and not just not care about what I'm doing to the weave or to the wig, which I still live for. But it's different when you start knowing that, oh, wait a minute, this is a rod set. All I need is, you know, my Cream of Nature Moisture and Shy Foam Mousse, you know what I mean, or my Curl Activator Cream, and I can put this in here and it can give me something different and new that I forgot was even there. So I think it was like I don't want to say reimagine, but it was kind of like a love story coming back again for me and my hair over my journey and really figuring out all the different styles that I could do with it.
Sounds like a reclamation.
Yes, I would say reclamation. That's a great word choice. Yeah.
Thank you very much. I do words sometimes.
But it's empowering when you can know what to do with your hair and when you have products that allow you to have the freedom to try new things. I think we forget that that's a part of the relationship with ourselves that we got to keep feeding.
You said, obviously, you live for, you know, the wig moment. But you wore your hair natural in Nope, and you were a little hesitant about doing that at the time. And then there's sort of like the spotlight of the drama in One of Them Days about Black women getting their hair braided, and sometimes it can take a little while.
Okay.
What is it like, though, wearing your natural hair, you know, so publicly? Because some people it is protective, right? Like, it is...
I think because of, obviously, you know, the elephant in the room is assimilation, right? You're constantly told what the standard of beauty is, and it doesn't include natural, kinky, coily hair, which is, again, why when Cream of Nature brought me on as a chief brand officer, that was my main thing, because a lot of times your natural hair is suddenly deemed as not in, not modern, old school. Okay, well, that's because in the 70s, that's when you mostly seen it. So that has to now be reimagined today by, what did you say? Reclamation, reclaiming that. This is, you know, according to the Crown Act, this is hair that's appropriate for work. This is hair that's appropriate on a fashion show. This is hair that's appropriate on a celebrity or a star or whoever, whatever you think, you know, the people that you see on TV. And so that, to me, has been the biggest thing that I've been excited to do with, you know, this position of being chief brand officer, is simply existing in my natural form. And then, of course, saying, hey, these are some products that can help you get on your journey. Whether you want to do the curly coils and you want to do your finger coil, get you the curl activator. If you want to do the foam mousse and the Style and Shine leave-in conditioner, hit yourself up with a little rod set. There's something there for everybody, but get into that journey, because while, yes, I'm going to always live for a wig, I'm going to always live for a weave, the feeling that I get when I'm living in my own hair, it does have a different breath, and I do have a different walk.
You also released a book late last year.
Yes,
congratulations. Oh, that thing, yes, congratulations.
I didn't know where you were going. I was like, oh, it was the book.
Oh, the book, yes. What, you know, what would you say is your message with that book? What do you want folks to take away from it?
I think the main thing that I think I realized, the 10-year difference from the first book I wrote, I Don't Belong to You, was that I realized, oh, wait a minute, life's never going to be perfect. It's not about trying to control circumstances outside of myself. It's about just controlling me, you know, and making sure that I am, you know, that I'm open to the changes and knowing that it's okay to pivot and that I'm going to make mistakes, but I'm going to learn from them. So just having more of kindness to yourself, you know what I'm saying? To me, self-mastery is about understanding that you can't control life's changes, but that it's going to be okay and that you're going to learn and have the things you need to be able to get through it and get past it.
What's next for Keke Palmer? You're doing a lot all the time. What's
you know,
next?
I would hope to, you know, really having a lot of fun as chief brand officer of Cream of Nature. I love the opportunity that I get to also, you know, encourage other young women to reclaim their hair and actually have really great products that can allow them to do that. So I'm looking forward to all those ways and the community aspect. I think that's the big thing, right? It's Black History Month. We have everybody out here tonight. I'm excited to go through all the history of hair. You know, Cream of Nature was started in 1976. Honey, we have a lot of hair history to get into. So excited to explore that tonight. And then outside of that, you know, yeah, like community with Key TV, my network. I'm excited to, you know, inspire, encourage, and help financially other artists out there and people in general that want to get in the industry, whether you are a cinematographer or you're a writer or you want to be a producer. You know, for me, the big thing with my brand, Keke Palmer brand, is that it should extend outside of myself. You know, I love performing. I'm always going to perform. It's a great thing. But I would also like to extend what that brand means to others, you know, in a way that feels tangible.
So uplifting others.
Yeah.
Next on your list.
Yeah.
All right. Congratulations, Keke Palmer.
You.
Thank you so much. Good meeting you.
Thank you. Good meeting you, too.
Of course. And the film One of Them Days, starring Keke Palmer and SZA, is in theaters right now. And that's our show for this Wednesday night. Stay connected with our reporters and what they're working on by following us on Instagram at WTTW Chicago. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and a special time at 10:30. President Trump pauses his plan for hiking tariffs on goods from Canada and Mexico. A look at the potential impact if he follows through. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight Black Voices, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that is proud to be a multilingual law firm that provides translators for a variety of languages.